It's a pleasure to be back. I had so much fun last week. For those of us who were here, you're already laughing. We had a good time, didn't we? Let's keep that going. We will keep that going. Thank you very much for being here. I am joining you today from the smoky skies of very North California, where I've had a lot of dukkha around difficult air quality, and I know that it's really not good today coming all the way down the Northern California coast into San Francisco. I know that it is difficult air in many places, and I just want to start from naming the difficulty that so many people around the globe are living inside of, the natural climate difficulties that we're having. And so just touching into the climate of your own heart, your own mind today, however you're showing up, you're entirely welcome. You know, we show up to our 2-hour retreat exactly as we are, and sometimes the conditions are just right, and sometimes the conditions are challenging, and this practice helps us meet whatever the conditions are. So in this moment, I'm feeling very grateful for the technology that brings us together, and the technology that built an air filter, an air purifier that I can have going. And, you know, these ways in which we're adapting, ways in which we're adapting. So good morning to you all. And this is also I come from the land of the Wiat tribe, and many of you probably know who the indigenous people are of the land where you are too, and just taking a moment to do an internal bow of this shared space that we have, whether it's unceded or, as some people say, stolen, because it is. But here we are in our homes, wherever we are, grateful for that we can be here given all of our conditions. So one of my favorite things that I love to do when we begin our Wednesday morning time together is look at each other. Whether, you know, if you can turn your video on for a minute, that's great. I totally understand if you can't. You might be driving, you might be somewhere else that it just doesn't work for you. But isn't it sweet just to look at each other's faces and take each other in? And of course, nobody knows who's looking at whom at any given moment, so no need to be shy. Just take a gander at our sangha and know how much each one of us is necessary for the depth and the breadth and the health of our community to be here together. You can see each other smiling. Isn't this great? It's just the sweetest thing. So as I teach, I always keep my, I keep that gallery view on until we get to a Q&A, and then I can really see the person who's asking a question. But I love keeping gallery view on because I feel like I'm truly in the room with everybody. So you might try that too. Just let me be small. You don't have to have me big all over your monitor. You can just be in the room together. All right, so how we will do our morning, we'll start shortly with an arriving meditation. I'll talk a little bit, some Dharma thoughts, do a little bit of a recap from last week to bring those in who may not have been here, and then we'll have a longer meditation, and then I'll offer today's talk, which is a continuation of last week. Any questions before we dive in? Okay, all right, so finding a posture that feels most natural for you to come into this time this morning. Whether you're seated or standing, maybe even reclining. Sensing into this body. Maybe with a sense of, oh, coming to Sangha again, back to practice, this formal practice again. Welcoming yourself. becoming aware of place by noticing sounds around you, whether they're nearby or farther away. Becoming aware of temperature. Anywhere from hot to cold, cool or warm, and is there an inclination to adjust? Are you comfortable? Letting yourself come into a posture that is natural and comfortable and suits you best for right now. Breathe and know you're breathing. Nothing special to do. Arriving here. Settling here. And welcoming yourself in the company of each other. The breath comes in on its own. It goes out on its own. And with each exhale, inviting a quality of softening and relaxing right into this time. That sense of coming back again. Coming back again to be with dear friends. The comfort and safety of that, the refuge of that. We'll begin with this poem from Rosemary Wautola Traumer. It's called Morning After. Again, the chance to praise the same room, the same floor, the same view, the same tea, which today is startlingly not the same. Again, the chance to find the miracle in the leaves that fall, the miracle in the morning sun, the miracle in the willows beside the pond. Again, the chance to fall in love with the same sky, the same field, the same dirt, the same broken world. Again, the chance to show up with these same tired arms and put them to work, the same work as yesterday, which is to learn to lift up, to heal, to carry, to build, to be in the world, to praise the same room, the same floor, the same view, the same tea. Thank you. Good morning again. Good morning again. We come back again and again, don't we? You know, so many of us come to this Sangha or other Sanghas, multiple places where we come back and we keep showing up for our lives in many different ways. And again, it's a chance to praise. It's a chance to say, I woke up again, I'm here again, to train in this beautiful practice of presence, of compassion, of courage, all in the service of wisdom. So last week, we took a deep dive into the refuges and the precepts. And if you want to go back and listen to it, if you weren't here last week, do that. It will put today's talk in a little more context, but also if you just like to hear a little bit of a deeper dive into refuges, taking refuge in the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha. And looking at those refuges, this place where we start as a framework. And then we talked about the precepts, those universal guidelines to non-harming, as a way to approach what we can do, not from a punitive view about don't do this, don't do that, but actually, how do we use the framework of the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, the earth, the necessity to treat the earth as a refuge, something we care so deeply for, where we find support. That is the framework, and out of that framework, the scaffolding is built. And I use the metaphor, the analogy of let's let the precepts be the scaffolding. There's these guidelines of our ethics and our morality. And later in today's talk, we'll talk about faith, the practice of confidence and trust as the glue that holds this framework and the scaffolding and this framework together. And I love this poem from Rosemary, that we might think it's all the same all the time, and yet it's not, right? Everything is always changing, yet there's a way in which it can feel the same. But when we can approach our lives from this place of praise, which is to bow down to whatever it is that is here, and trust that we can meet it, it's again the chance to see the same everything in a new light, or maybe with a new orientation. But I love what she says at the end of this poem, the chance to show up with the same tired arms and put them to work, the same work as yesterday, which is to learn to lift up, to heal, to carry, to build, to be in the world, to praise the same floor, same room, same view, same tea. This is the path of the Bodhisattva, right? We keep showing up. And I've been spending a lot of time thinking about and reading about, studying a bit deeper, what is this path of the Bodhisattva, the one who truly can meet what is happening. The world is suffering. It's my job to meet it. That's what the Bodhisattva is. And we are all Bodhisattvas, because we're showing up over and over again to cultivate a practice that deepens our understanding of how things work, to deepen our understanding of the Dharma, which is the nature of things, and how do we meet that? How do we keep showing up over and over and over again? So just to give you a little recap on the funny part. So last week when we were talking, look at Cindy cracking up. I love that. When we were talking about the precepts and we got to wise speech, I was really wanting to give an example to get this out of a conceptual thing about we do this, we don't do this. This is how we can be with our lives from in really cultivating these ethics. I was telling the story about my husband and I getting our house painted and choosing the wrong color. And it's a really big house. And what we were going to do about, oh my God, we need to deal with this horrible color that we chose. And I needed to take responsibility for having chosen the color. which I did. And it, I, like I said last week, it took all the heat down and we were able to move forward. I just want to report that the new color is going great. That's all I want to say is that it's growing on me. I go outside and I look at it and I say, yeah, that's good. That's good. So, you know, that's the good end of the story. And next month when I'm here, it will be all done and I'll show you a picture. And you don't have to say, ooh, I love it. You can just say, okay, good. Job well done. We did it. 'Cause you know, that's just how it is. So I just wanted to tell you the end of the story. Or not quite at the end, but it's going well. It's going well. All right. The other thing we did last week is we began a discussion about the work of the Zen peacemakers. And I want to go further into that in a little while. And the Zen peacemakers are a beautiful organization who that is dedicated to engaged spiritual practice. How do we show up and do good in the world and cultivate our spiritual lives and see them as the same? They're really not separate. Because how could they be separate if we take on precepts and we make a dedication to study and live our lives from a place of non-harming? It's not only for ourselves. And, you know, one of the definitions of the bodhisattva is the one who commits to really taking, doing his or her best to show up to care for everyone for their whole life. And we'll talk more about that. So the Zen peacemakers are really a beautiful organization. The other thing I want to bring in here before we sit, there was some question that I got later about, could you repeat those two things? So here are these two pieces from the Dhammapada that have been very important for me in guiding my own practice. And I think they guide both the refuges and the precepts. And ultimately, they guide our practice of faith, of trust, confidence. So here are the two teachings. Avoid what is unskillful, do what is good, and purify the mind. This is the teaching of the Buddhas. Very basic, right? But we don't need necessarily to have complex, esoteric, abstract teachings to get to the heart of it. And this is actually something I really love about so many of these teachings is they're completely accessible. Avoid what is unskillful, do what is good, and purify the mind. This is the meditation practice. This is the teaching of the Buddha. And the second one honors our differences. Honors that we all have a different way of meeting our lives and avoiding what is unskillful and doing what is good and even our meditation practice. It can come in lots of different ways. And here's what it is. Whatever path of action you find that brings good and happiness to all, follow this way like the moon in the path of the stars. All right, that is such a beautiful teaching about we honor who each of us is. You choose what works for you, but dedicate yourself to the good of everyone and find your own way. Find your own way. Whatever path of action you find that brings good and happiness to all, follow this way, like the moon in the path of the stars. So those two teachings I find orient my compass. They keep my North Star shining. And I don't always get it right. I mean, of course I don't always get it right, but I can rely on the refuges. I can rely on the precepts. And I can rely on these Dharma teachings. And I hope you do too. And probably you do because you keep coming back over and over again. There's something going on here that is a refuge, right? Practice is a refuge. Sangha is a refuge. Then let's move into our meditation. because last week it was a little bit short, and I went on and on and on about the precepts and the refuges, and it took us a really long time to get to our meditation. So we'll get right to it. So once again, finding a posture that really works in your body. Again, it can be sitting, it can be standing. Can be reclining. Breathe and know you're breathing. With each exhale, inviting yourself to soften anywhere in the body that might be tense or holding. Maybe intentionally softening the face. Especially including unhinging the jaw. Letting the tongue rest gently in the mouth. As the shoulders drop, the scapula float down the back a little bit. There's a way in which when the shoulders drop and the scapula float down the back, the heart lifts a little. Letting the muscles of the belly soften. Maybe you even notice the motion of the belly with the breath cycle. Letting the base of the body hold you, yet giving over the weight of your body to the furniture, to the floor, whatever you're connected to. Trusting that you will be held right here. Holding just enough energy in the back body, from the tailbone to the crown of the head, to stay attentive and awake, present. And letting the whole front of the body be soft, yet alive, responsive. Making space to breathe in between the front body and the back body. And sensing into the state of the heart. However the heart is today, letting it be just as it is. The delight, the agitation, the sorrow, the contentment, whatever it might be. It might be several energies present at once. However the heart is, it is. Welcoming ourselves to be exactly as we are right now. Bringing a quality of friendliness in, care, compassion. You might enjoy the beautiful intention phrases Sylvia has given us. May I meet this moment fully. May I meet it as a friend. You can use that as your anchor for your meditation if you like. perhaps on the inhale, saying to yourself gently, may I meet this moment fully. And on the exhale, may I meet it as a friend. Showing up completely with kindness. And then choosing where you want to place your attention for this meditation, whether it's on the breath, where you feel the breath the most in your body, whether it's in the body, just being with sensation, maybe of the feet or the seat or the hands or somewhere else. Maybe you choose metta practice. Whatever it is, it's again the chance to be here. In some ways, to praise this moment simply by your presence. When the mind drifts away, again the chance to begin again. Gentle, quiet, caring persistence. And we'll sit for a bit. Once again, sensing the stability of the back body, letting it hold you here. Inviting the whole front of the body to soften so there's space to breathe in between. And checking to see if any habitual holding is present. And if so, giving your body permission to release any amount. Giving your heart permission to open any amount. Giving your mind permission to simply settle, be here. Noticing how the mind is quieting a bit. Maybe the body is relaxing a little more. And even if there's chatter or agitation or sleepiness, anything that might be taking you away from this breath, this body, this moment, it's okay. It's just what happens. Again, the chance to praise this moment, just here. And now widening out the awareness from having a smaller view, if you've been staying with the sensation or staying with the breath, see if you can move out to a more expanded awareness, not necessarily focusing on one particular thing, but letting the quiet that has developed, let that quiet awareness be a little bigger. Maybe as if you are experiencing this presence from maybe 30,000 feet or the top of a hill where you can see more broadly, not needing to do anything in particular. It's simply widening out the awareness. And within that awareness, thoughts come, they hang out, they go. Sensations do the same thing. They come, they stir around, they go. Even emotional energies of the heart come, stir around, and they go. Letting yourself just simply rest here in this bigger awareness. And of course, if the mind gets a little lost or hijacked, notice the lost or hijacked and come back, re-steady, and let this wider awareness be here. And now from wherever you are, coming into the heart center, really sensing into the space of your own heart. Maybe placing a hand on the chest, if that's helpful to you, to connect, to really feel the physical sense of the warmth of your own body, touching itself and the warmth of your heart. Even if you're having a cool heart day, there's probably a little warmth in there. And just breathing in and out of this heart space, this heart's breath. If you like, imagining fresh, nourishing energy coming into the heart space from every direction. And as you breathe out, back out into every direction, the energy of your heart, the goodness of your heart goes out into the world, but it also releases whatever you want to release. Goodness in, nourishing energy in, goodness and nourishing energy out, and also a quality of releasing. This way, the heart becomes spacious and stable, open, available, the heart's breath. Offering yourself some metta. Maybe you have your own phrases, or you can use these. May I feel safe and protected. May I be contented and pleased. May I be gentle and kind. May my heart be open and free. And this time, see if you might feel the felt sense. Actually, what does it feel like in the body to imagine these qualities infusing your whole being? Safe and protected. Contented and pleased. Gentle and kind. Open and free. This is called Komara by Julia Fehrenbacher. It's a brave thing to step onto the field, into the arena, to each day, to turn toward blank page, empty canvas, to choose to meet this beautiful broken world all over again, to sit inside the mess, the mayhem, the I don't know. It's a brave thing to rise up when you've hit the ground hard, to sit still when fear wants you to pick it up, pin it down, to let dust settle instead of hurrying to wipe it clean. It's a brave thing to forget the filters, to forgive the unforgivable, to let hurt be the hand that heals, to breathe until you feel your bigness, to soften, to open, to listen. In Rwanda, the word Komara means be strong, have courage, In the middle of the mess, the mayhem, the I don't know, it's a brave thing to slip off each story of smallness, to let hurt be the hand that heals, to take the next true step, even when. Okay, everybody, let's take 5 minutes, come back at 13 after the hour, and we'll keep going. Welcome back, everybody. Thank you for being here. I'm glad you are. So my intention for talking about the refuges and talking about the precepts and to show up with a heart of care, what else is it that we're doing? Like, what else is there to do? Again, the chance to praise, again, the chance to show up. And the invitation to show up fully is not easy. What does that mean? Each of us could spend some time reflecting on what does that actually mean to fully show up in mind, heart, body, because that could feel risky. It takes some courage to do that. What are the parts of ourselves that we don't want to include? What are the parts of ourselves we want to include? What are the parts of ourselves we really don't know very well? So it's actually complex. May I meet this moment fully, and may we together meet these moments fully, because it takes refuges, it takes precepts, it takes sticking with it. It takes trusting ourselves to be able to do this. And I think some days we have more capacity than others. And so to use that as a mantra, as an intention practice, a beautiful intention practice, may I meet this moment fully, is literally an instruction and an invitation. And within that, there's a lot of space, because we can actually, sometimes we can, sometimes we can't, to varying degrees. Sometimes we understand what that means, sometimes we don't understand what that means. What are the filters that we have? I mean, to show up fully. So it not only sounds good, right? Not only sounds good, but it is good, and it takes some real reflection. And may I meet it as a friend? That's the invitation to show up with a heart of friendliness, right? To actually bring our core, the truth. I think the truth is one of the things that is true is of humans is that at our core, we care. That there's a very real heart of caring that is inside every single person. And that is also has varying degrees of accessibility. You know, maybe one of the most awful phrases is, I couldn't care less. Sylvia talks about that sometimes, but it's true. And because we do deeply care, typically, especially about ourselves, because we're self-referential, and I'm not saying that in a negative way at all, but we learn to care for others oftentimes through the practice of learning to care for ourselves. Though sometimes we learn to care for ourselves through the practice of learning to care for others, that it applies to us too. So May I meet this moment fully. May I meet this moment as a friend. That might be all the Dharma practice instruction we need, because it is all there. I have a friend of mine took a photograph from a trip that we made together, and she had that printed on the front of the photograph. And it's what we're doing, you know, it is what we're doing. So I'm glad that was nurturing for you today, and that was good to bring that back. Write it down, stick it on your mirror, do whatever you want, but it's a profound teaching. And it is a piece of legacy that Sylvia has given us that will always be relevant and will always be alive. It's a piece of Dharma that we can trust. And so then let's take that right into how do we show up? I want to talk about this radical presence that those instructions ask us to do. And when I say radical, I don't mean extremist, I mean complete. Thorough, from the root, training in being present. How do we show up? Can we stay once we show up? Is it too hard? Is what we see really hard? This is, again, the path of the Bodhisattva, the one that says, I commit to meeting the suffering of the world. And then can we take appropriate action? So we need to cultivate this mindfulness. We need to cultivate compassion, loving awareness, courage, and wisdom. And I rely, you know, another one of these teachings that I really rely upon, like the other ones from the Dhammapada that I brought in earlier, is this definition of mindfulness, or what mindfulness, not a definition of mindfulness, this is more what mindfulness does. This is from Thich Nhat Hanh, where he says, mindfulness allows us to look deeply and see what's going on. It means seeing and knowing what's going on. To me, that is the crux of the matter. May I meet this moment fully, may I meet it as a friend, and may I really understand what is going on, both internally and externally, and internally and externally. What is happening with me? What is happening with you, if I am in a conversation with you? What is happening between us? And mindfulness is this practice of cultivating self-awareness, situational awareness, and this regulation, self-regulation in between. That's a secular way of talking about what we're doing here. And it's important, I think, to be able to translate Dharma language into everyday secular language, because most of us aren't monastics, and the tongue, the language, the semantics that we use, it's important to make it your own, to also see how the Dharma relates to the everydayness of everything that we're doing. And that is important to me. I talked about that last week, and it is. This is what I think is really important about the Dharma, is to look at why does it matter and how is it supporting my life. So can I cultivate this self-awareness? Can I be in tune, aware enough to understand what's happening outside of me? And how do I meet it? That's the self-regulation. That's what we're doing. So this is not, mindfulness is not something we do. It is obviously a way of being, and it requires that curiosity, openness, willingness, the Pali word sati, S-A-T-I, which is often translated as mindfulness, but what I learned from Bhikkhu Anālayo is that sati actually is more accurately translated as a soft receptivity of mind, heart, which allows the mindfulness to arise. Because if the mind is closed, that's pretty hard to be mindful, right? We can't really see and know what's going on if we have a constricted mind. And this is where the fixed views come in. The mind gets restricted and tight, oftentimes out of fear, oftentimes out of all kinds of things that can keep us trapped, core limiting beliefs that can keep us stuck. So true mindfulness connected to the heart is loving awareness, as Ram Dass said, but we need the sati first. So let's bring in the work of Zen peacemakers. I want to expand on that a little bit because I've been very moved by their work. And I think about, as I said, I'm thinking more and more about the depth and breadth of the role of the bodhisattva and how I think we are all bodhisattvas in many ways. So here's the mission and the vision of Zen peacemakers, and you can look it up there. It's very easy. Just go online, zenpeacemakers.org, I think. It says, our mission is to realize our oneness and relieve suffering through contemplative social action. We envision an enlightened society where suffering is transformed into wisdom and compassion, and all beings live in harmony and are relieved of the afflictions of hunger, war, and disease. Spirituality and service are tools we use to help all beings find freedom, regardless of race, religion, ability, gender, or nationality. So that's pretty lofty, right? That's really lofty. But we start with the big vision. Let's start with this could be possible. This is the end of suffering, the third noble truth that says peace is possible. And that is the fuel that fires the energy and the motivation of the bodhisattva. So there are three primary tenets for Zen peacemakers, which I've also been very taken with, and I'm doing a lot of thinking about it. And this was first developed and articulated by Roshi Bernie Glassman, who died in 2018. And he's a colleague of Roshi Joan Halifax, and he was a giant in the world of engaged Buddhism. So these three tenets are not knowing. That's the first one. The second one is bearing witness. And the third is taking action. So let's talk about these three. Not knowing. What is it like to show up and say, I don't know? This beginner's mind. You know, Suzuki Roshi, who said so over and over again, in the beginner's mind, there are many possibilities. And in the expert's mind, there are few. How many times do we approach whatever we're doing with, yeah, I already heard that, I know how to do it. And we become very habitual. This is just part of being a human. But this practice is asking us to let go or suspend our loyalty to our own opinions long enough to listen to another, to say what else might be a factor, what else is going on here. To letting go of fixed ideas about ourselves and each other, even the world. And then this leads to these core limiting beliefs. What are these deeply held beliefs that are core? But do they limit our ability to consider other ways of being? Do they cause harm to ourselves or one another? Now, that is not to say that aligning our lives with the values of goodness and non-harming, those beliefs, we're talking about unwholesome beliefs. We're talking about the inability to widen out and listen to another view. It doesn't mean that those core wholesome beliefs are not valuable. They are. They're incredibly important. But we're talking about belief systems that prevent us from really inhabiting our lives in a bigger way. Are you with me on that? I'm drawing that distinction between wholesome and unwholesome core beliefs. Not knowing requires us to reframe a narrative. Because we can look out and see a certain situation and assess it from our own viewpoint. But to be able to say what else is true, how might somebody else be looking at this? Is incredibly powerful, takes courage, can be scary because it might rock our world a little bit. So we can approach it from that really great these two questions. Okay, what is still true? What is still true? Lots of difficult things are still true. And what else is true? Which takes us into possibility. It also takes us into a bigger viewpoint. So not knowing, the Buddha said it, right? As I said earlier in the Metta Sutta, by not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having given up all unwholesome, addictive desires, is freed from suffering. And I think that when my judgmental mind is activated, I don't feel as well. Things are difficult. I get stuck. But things are easier. There's more space when my judgmental mind is quiet, when I really can say what else is true. There might be another way to think about something. And what's really interesting is that in the work of Richie Davidson, who's the neuropsychiatrist, psychologist at Madison, University of Wisconsin in Madison, he's developed something called the theory of the happy brain, which identifies four different circuits in the brain that are responsible for our well-being, some of our well-being. And there is a circuit dedicated to reframing, to our outlook, which is very interesting, that we actually do have the brain capacity, the circuitry, to widen out the opinion, to say what else is going on. So this thing of not knowing is powerful. How do we show up with that kind of openness? From Wendell Berry, here's a small poem called Our Real Work. It may be that when we no longer know what to do, we have come to our real work, and that when we no longer know which way to go, we have come to our real journey. The mind that is not baffled is not employed. The impeded stream is the one that sings. That's a pretty cool poem. Let me read that to you again. It's short. It may be when we no longer know what to do, we've come to our real work. That when we no longer know which way to go, we've come to our real journey. The mind that is not baffled is not employed. The impeded stream is the one that sings. The real work is when we come to something and we give up. We give up our core limiting beliefs where we say, I just don't know. I'm just going to be here. I'm willing to find out. I'm willing to meet this moment fully and as a friend. And I do love the imagery of it's the impeded stream that sings. You know, think about a stream, a creek full of boulders and all the noise that is happening and all the different ways that water needs to find its way down in and around the obstacles. And if stuff just went by smoothly all the time, we wouldn't need this practice. But we know that dukkha is real, that dukkha is the way life is. And so we show up and say, okay, I'm here. The next one of these tenets, bearing witness to both the joy and the suffering of the world. Again, showing up willing. So Zen peacemakers talk about bearing witness as the practice to see all aspects of a situation, including our attachments and judgments. All of these are woven together. In some ways, they say the same thing. When you bear witness, you open to the uniqueness of whatever is arising and meet it just as it is. It can strengthen your capacity to listen to other points of view and allow a more nuanced picture of a situation to observe, to emerge. You know, I really appreciate that piece of allowing a more nuanced picture to emerge, because nuance takes into account subtlety, right? There's this way and this way and this way. There is not one way. So when we understand more deeply from a broader place, the chance of responding in a more wholesome, appropriate way is much higher, and the suffering decreases. When we don't have to create trouble, where we don't have to hold things so tightly, to bear witness. And interestingly, about Bernie Glassman, he's the one who started the bearing witness retreats, where he'd take people to Auschwitz and Birkenau. And what a brave thing, right? Talking about bravery, to go there and be with all of that suffering. And then he would facilitate groups who experienced that kind of loss in the same room, people who are descendants of SS officers, people who are descendants of those who were lost in the Holocaust, all different kinds of suffering and genocide, to bear witness, to show up. What kind of bravery that is. And in that showing up, there might be, you know, I think that what we come face to face with, or what the Buddha taught, we come around the three poisons. We come in face to face to a tangible experience of greed and ill will and delusion. When we really bear witness, when we really show up for anything, very likely we will experience some dukkha, because these three universal facts of life around dukkha is true for everyone. Everything is impermanent for sure. It is all in the process of change all the time, and that everything is connected to everything else. And I think that this piece of not self, of understanding interconnection, is the deepest way to understand the Bodhisattva. That because everything and everyone is somehow connected to everything and everyone else, from little circles out to the biggest, what other way is there than to be a Bodhisattva, to say, okay, I'm going to meet this suffering. So we experience the multiple flavors of greed, graspiness, I want this, I want more, I want less, I push it away, the ill will. So, you know, when we can talk about this view versus that view, naming right and wrong, othering, all of that comes under that poison of ill will. And also delusion, ignorance, not seeing clearly. And we experience the Vedana, the comfort, discomfort and comfort, pleasant and unpleasant, even joy. So this bearing witness practice brings us into a direct experience, I think, with everything the Buddha taught, the joy and the sorrow, the full range of experience. And peace is joyful, right? The ability to do this work at all can bring in joy, contentment. It might be hard work, but we actually can, I hope, through the showing up, meeting this moment fully and meeting it with a kind heart, there is contentment, there is satisfaction. There is knowing this is important, good work that can bring about goodness, to experience goodness from showing up. And when you know you're in a moment of goodness, seriously, I'm being really serious about this right now, savor it. When you got a good thing going, you got to know it. Be that present to notice, oh, things are good right now. It doesn't mean that others aren't suffering, or that an hour from now you're going to be engaged in something that is maybe a little difficult, because joy and sorrow exist in the same place. So when you know that things are actually okay right in this moment, the practice of savoring is really important. Savoring meaning being very present with, tasting it. Actually being present with the feeling inside. When you're truly present with something that's positive, spending time with a friend and you know you're having a great time, like really know it, or you're in a, eating a meal of something that is so delicious that you take your time. Because savoring is a quality of lingering, and when we linger and relish and savor what is good, it encodes it in our brain, in our nervous system, so we actually can experience goodness in that moment and we can bring it back when we need it, which is most of the time, you know, to bring back the goodness that is in our life. And I was listening to an interview with a researcher, his name is Fred Bryant, who's out of Loyola University in Chicago. He was just on a podcast called The Hidden Brain, talking about savoring and his book called Savoring, A New Model for Positive Experience. And it can come about from bearing witness, right? Showing up and being utterly present. But he's been studying savoring for about 40 years. And really what I got out of his listening to his talk was that this is what the Buddha's been teaching. This is what we are studying, is what happens when we are so present for our lives. We experience goodness, which leads to compassion, which leads to wise action. It's not all about what's painful in the world at all. I think Thich Nhat Hanh is the one who said, happiness is here, please help yourself. Please help yourself. Can we see it? Can we allow that in? So this practice of bearing witness takes us into the presence of everything, absolutely everything, from the most despairing to the most joyful, because it's brave and it's courageous to show up for it all. So it can lead to happiness and contentment, a clearer mind and a strengthened heart, which leads us to the third of these tenets, which is taking action, right? Knowing wise action, what is the most appropriate response? It arises from not knowing, it arises from bearing witness to a caring action. Let's say wise action is caring action. And Zen peacemakers say, it's impossible to predict what the action in any situation will be, or a timetable for when it will arise, or what might result from it. So are we willing to let go of attachment to outcome and just show up and do the work? The underlying intention is that action that arises be a caring action which serves everyone and everything, including ourselves and the whole situation. We are not separate from this. Bodhisattvas are included in all of this. So, showing up not knowing, bearing witness, taking caring action, it's not easy. It's hard, and we do it anyway. We do it anyway. And sometimes we do it more, sometimes we do it less. But every time we engage in any part of this, I think that it fortifies our motivation, our intention. We come back to Sangha because it helps support that structure, that scaffolding. And we know the world is suffering. And our role is to show up for it. It's not up to each one of us to do the whole thing, but we can't stop. We need to participate. The other talk that I mentioned last week, I want to remind you about it again, is on Tricycle Talks, and it's an interview that James Shaheen did with Rebecca Solnit. And Rebecca is a brilliant writer and thinker and very involved in engaged Buddhism and climate work. And she was talking about all kinds of things, reimagining our role, understanding who we are in relation to all of this. And she's hopeful. She's very hopeful. And I really recommend you listening to this. But what she was talking about was after Katrina in New Orleans, when was that, 2005 or six, something like that, and thousands of people were affected and many people got in their boats to go help those who were stranded. And what she said is nobody saved everybody, but a lot of people saved somebody. That's the work of the Bodhisattva. So she says, get your boat in the water. You're not going to rescue everybody, but it's not your job to do it all by yourself. And rescuing somebody is deeply meaningful, even if you can't rescue everybody. Nobody rescued everybody, and a lot of people rescued somebody. Isn't that beautiful? So this is what we're doing. This is what this means. May I meet this moment fully. May I meet it as a friend. I don't have to know all the answers, but I got to show up and I got to act in some caring way. And nobody said it's going to be easy, but there might be some joy. So to end this part, I'm obviously not getting to the discussion of faith, am I? I keep saying I'm going to do that. Probably going to have to wait till next month. Joanna Macy, who you're very likely familiar with, she too is, she's a pioneer of engaged Buddhism, social action connected with spiritual practice. And in her book, Active Hope, which is a wonderful book, she talks about how do we commit to this kind of wise action, to showing up. And, you know, the Bodhisattva vow, the traditional Bodhisattva vow says something like, creations are numberless, I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to transform them. Reality is boundless, I vow to perceive it. The awakened way is unsurpassable, I vow to embrace it. Well, that might sound really confusing or not really practical. Like, what is this really saying about? And I think what it's really saying is the suffering, the world is suffering. It's my job to meet it. But here's what Joanna offers as the vow to herself to keep showing up, not knowing, working towards taking the right action. She says, I vow to myself and each of you to commit myself daily to the healing of our world and the welfare of all beings, to live on the earth more lightly and less violently in the food, products, and energy I consume, to draw strength and guidance from the living earth, the ancestors, the future generations, and my brothers and sisters of all species, to support others in our work for the world, and to ask for help when I need it, to pursue a daily practice that clarifies my mind, strengthens my heart, and supports me in observing these vows. I think that's really beautiful. It's much more accessible and tangible than archaic language, which I think the other one is kind of archaic language. So maybe you write your own commitment. What does it mean for you to show up and be present, to not know, to participate in a way that makes sense for you? Back to that piece from the Dhammapada, whatever path of action brings good and happiness to all, follow that way. Like the moon in the path of the stars. This is how we bring this all together. So you might be thinking, that all sounds great, and how am I going to do that? And this is why I want to talk about the practice of trust and confidence and faith, but we'll do that next month. When you show up for Sangha, when you sit on your cushion, when you start your day with any kind of wholesome intention, that's how you do it. To know that all of us are doing this together, and it's not just the 34 of us here on camera right now. It's millions of people around the globe that are practicing showing up and willing to be with what is painful and really also being close to what is joyful. And we need both. We need both. So I'm going to end there. Our dedication of merit is this today. Just as water flowing in the streams and rivers fill the ocean, thus may all your moments of goodness touch and benefit all beings, those here now and those gone before. Beautiful blessing chant. Thank you for being here, everybody. It's such an honor and such a pleasure. And I will be here. Sylvia's the next 2 weeks. I'll be here the last 2 weeks of September. Join me anytime for anything.